It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Tonight at Heinz Hall, percussion moves from its traditional spot at the back of the orchestra and takes center stage as the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra presents the world premiere of Stuart Copeland's The Tyrant's Crush, concerto for drum set and percussion. Stuart Copeland is best known around the world as a founding member and the drummer of the reggae-influenced rock supergroup The Police. He's a five-time Grammy winner and, along with his Police bandmates Sting and Andy Summers, he is also a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He joins me now in studio. Stuart Copeland, good to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Not since the Dave Clark Five have the drums been out front like this. But seriously, you will join the Pittsburgh Symphony for the performance of your own work. Explain the setup here for us.
Well, actually, since I went the rock and roll route and had kind of a good ride with that, I had 20 years before the mast as a hired gun, flinty-eyed film composer, which teaches you a thing or two about how to make music, because you have to be very specific. You have to go places that an artist wouldn't go. My first film for Francis Coppola, one afternoon he turned around and said, we need some strings. And I saw what was coming, which would be that he would hire some string guy to ruin all my music. And so I said, sure, Francis, I got this. Yes, sure, strings. Yep, coming right up. You betcha. And so I call the contractor, says, send me some strings. He says, well, how many? I don't know. How many strings is strings? Strings. Send me some strings. Francis wants strings. Send me strings. So he sent over 20, 30 guys, something like that. I got, I figured out the chords that I'd been playing. I never named any of the chords. I just said this chord here, that black note there, and then the white note here, and, you know, roll tape, and I play that. But I got it onto a page with help. So the guys come in, the players come in, and there I am in the studio with these string players. And I tried to talk to them the way you would with a guitarist. Look, I need some groove here, and then when it goes to that last kind of just kind of vamps out, they're just kind of like groove on that, and they're looking more and more concerned as I go on with this. And finally, one of them says, Maestro, do you want us to play what's on the page here or whatever the hell you're talking about? And okay, let's play what's on the page. And so they did in about 10 seconds. And my three-hour session, which is what you book when you're booking a guitarist, because you want to try all of his guitars, every one of his amps, his wah-wah pedal, and his fuzz box. And you spend all afternoon chatting him up and talking to him and getting him into the vibe. And not so when it's on the page. You put the page in front of them, they just play it. And so began a relationship with the printed page, music on the page, which is a dictatorship. When you play in a band, music of the ear, you have to think on your feet. You lock into the music with your ears and your instincts. You just know when four bars are up. Music of the page is all about the eyes, and you connect with the music with a different part of your brain. The music gets to your fingers via your eyes. It's the music on the page, and even the time comes from the conductor's baton, visual cues. And the good thing about that is that playing in a rock band, you think on your feet, but orchestral music, it's all about the homework. And I got all day for homework of this kind. And at home, in the quiet, you can hone it. You can decide on different instruments, make musical decisions about which instrument should be playing this and how many of that instrument, and develop it and texturize it in all different kinds of way, much more complex kind of way. You know, you play rock and roll, there's really only three chords you need to bother with, E, A, and D. Okay, if you want to get fancy, throw in a G. But you grow up, and your tastes become a little more sophisticated, I suppose, or a little more complex anyway. And those other textures start to seem a little more enticing than the same old, same old.
You're a composer accompanying a full-scale orchestra on a drum set, along with other percussionists, and everything is out in front of the orchestra. And I think just the fact that you've composed this work and you are playing the drums, I mean, that alone must seem inconceivable to some of the people that you're associating with for this.
I guess it doesn't strike me as all that exotic, because I guess the journey that got me here, one thing leads to another. I've got a concerto for gamelan and orchestra for the Dallas Symphony. I was commissioned to write for the Seattle Symphony, where I performed with them. I haven't counted them up. It depends on how you count a concerto. But it's not the first. I've actually been doing this for quite some time.
But this one is your first with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra.
Absolutely. And boy, let me say, I was rehearsing with this band this morning, and that is the tightest first reading I've ever experienced. And in that hall is very brilliant as well. And this is going to really be good. Usually the first time, the first run through with an orchestra, it's a little scratchy, a little tentative. And when I'm playing drums with them, I'm very defined. My instrument is very defining. It's the nature of the percussive nature of it. It defines. And you have to, but here the orchestra was very tight, right on it. This is going to go well.
The members of the PSO percussion and timpani sections, you have Andrew Reamer, Jeremy Branson, Christopher Allen, and Edward Stefan. They probably grew up listening to the Police. So as you walk in, what is their reaction to your being there?
Oh, we're brothers of the stick. And in fact, I try and get along pretty well with the whole orchestra. I go and I schmooze before I get there an hour early, before the conductor is even in the room. I'm already chatting with the brass players about their mutes, fussing with the harpist about her pedals, talking to the first chair violin about bowing, and I like it. I like the feeling. I like the atmosphere of exchanging ideas. And that's where I'm learning a lot of stuff too. You know, talking to the trumpet player about, you know, when to pull out a D trumpet, when to pull out a piccolo, because I've learned that no matter what you put in the score, this passage here on piccolo trumpet or trumpet in D. Yeah, right. He pulls out whatever trumpet suits him and that is going to be the easiest or have the best sound in that range. And there's a lot you can learn just by mingling with the orchestra before the conductor gets there.
And they're all playing an array of exotic instruments, the percussionists are. So what is it going to
be? Well, actually, no, they're not. They're playing the standard orchestral percussion. When I wrote the gamelan piece, that was some exotic. And the players there also were improvisers. But the first movement of this was commissioned by the Liverpool Symphony and Paul Troon's In Paradise, the first movement. And after having written the gamelan piece with the Wild Texas guys, talked to the lead percussionist. So anyone play trap set? No. Bongos? Not so much. Any improvisation there? Oh, no. In fact, boy, you've never seen 60 people hide under their desks faster than when you say, anyone want to take a solo? Improvise? Oh, boy. This means that I had to write every darned note, which is rewarding and challenging. But the only thing that's exotic is the bowed saw,
right?
Where perk one pulls out a saw, such as you would cut a log with, and applies a violin bow to it, and is actually able to carry a tune. It's the notes that I wrote for it are very simple and long, so you don't have to do anything fancy. But it's very atmospheric, and the notes are pretty easy to hit and hold, and it's more about atmosphere than pitch accuracy. And I think that's the only exotic thing. The rest are the standard Gran Casa, the tam-tam, the piatti, and the mallet instruments, marimba, crotales. I think there's even some vibraphone in there.
Describe for us, if you can, what this is all going to sound like.
It's an attempt to write a percussion concerto that isn't a headache. And there are a lot of percussion concertos out there, as a matter of fact. And Ionosphere, for instance, and all these other ones. But mostly they're written by non-percussionists, and their concept of percussion is noise. And so they're like tone poems. And most of them give me a headache. But there's no reason why that should be so. The percussion instruments can actually do beautiful, even legato things, if you understand the instruments better than some of these people writing percussion concertos. And so my intention is to achieve beauty with these instruments. But that's a sub-mission in the larger mission, which is to make the whole orchestra rock the house. You know, I'm not attempting to be Mendelssohn. I have no intention of being Brahms or any of that. I am a rock musician, and I bring those sensibilities to the orchestra because I feel that an orchestra can be a powerful modern instrument, and there are a million things, as I learned in film composing, where you have to get the orchestra to do stuff. It's not about music. It's about an emotion. You need to express, you need to signal emotions very specifically. And you use the instruments in a way that by necessity, you discover things. And I've discovered that there are all kinds of things that never occurred to Brahms. Even though the symphonic orchestra has been around for centuries, there is still cool stuff that hasn't been done on it. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking to achieve with the orchestra what a rock band can achieve. It's never going to be that. I mean, I'm moving in that direction. I don't expect to actually get there. We're not going to be playing stadiums with this kind of stuff.
Did writing and performing with The Police, which was a band where the drums and the bass are, you know, right out front in terms of the sound that you were creating back then, did that give you confidence to do the kind of thing that you're doing tonight?
There isn't much of a connection in that sense. The experience of not just of playing in a rock band, but also going to a lot of rock concerts. It's more the world of rock music, the two-way street, the call and response. The concert stage, these orchestral music and, you know, classical music is a one-way street. You sit very quietly. When I'm listening to Brahms, I would like people on my left and right to shut up, please, so I can get my Brahms. But this isn't that concert. And there's a lot of power, there's a lot of joy, a lot of emotional charge that comes from the audience responding. It's not just an ego trip for the performer to hear the audience responding. It affects the audience as well. The audience feels the charge around them, and they become aroused by themselves in that way. The sound of the audience around them, it's a mob thing, I guess you can say. And I like that mob thing. And I don't expect, at Heinz Hall with the PSO to achieve a Rage Against the Machine concert. But I would like, and I'm attempting to bring some of those sensibilities, the call and response, two-way street. You can make as much noise at my concert as you want. In fact, if I inspire a noise from you, I've achieved something. It's in a way, it's more important. It's the purpose of that little melody that you might be obscuring. The reason I wrote that melody is to get a response. So the response is more important than my humble music. I'll send an SOS to the world. I'll send an SOS to the world. I hope that someone gets mine. I hope that someone gets mine. I hope that someone gets my message in a bottle.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Stuart Copeland. Tonight, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra is presenting the world premiere of Mr. Copeland's The Tyrant's Crush, and he will be out front playing drums. As you approach this, as you compose this and wrote it, do you end up writing something like this with you playing the drums in mind? Does that influence how you write it? Are you writing it to work to your advantage in terms of the style that you play, or is it something that anybody else could step in and play?
Well, that would really be the smart way to do it. But it doesn't quite work that way. This sounds terrible, but I think of the drums last. I just write the music. And to write the sensation is that the music writes itself, and I'm just here catching it as it lands on me and I get it onto the page. That's what it actually feels like. It feels more like discovery. And so I discover this music, and I put it on the page. And since this was commissioned as a piece for drums and orchestra, unlike other orchestral works that I've done, where I don't even have a staff, there's the whole orchestral score, and there's no staff which says drums. I know the piece. I play along. I hit the hits where I know where they are. I know where it goes quiet. I know where it gets loud. I know where the punch is. And I just make it up as I go along. I make my part up. I know that the music is written on the page. There's 60 guys scrutinizing that page, diligently playing in sync, everything. But since I'm confident that they are where I know where they are, I can jam on it. I can improvise around it. I go up and down, that's what keeps it alive.
So is it like an actor, they might improv a scene, and then they lock it? So if you improvise something, then it's locked in as a part of the symphony?
No, it's sort of the other way around. I think this wouldn't work for two actors doing a scene. But if one of the actors is reading his script, what I play is hits the same hits every night.
Uh-huh.
But how I hit the hits, whether it's with a snare drum or a cymbal. So it's the same rhythm. It's the same thing, but sometimes I'll go diddle-diddle-diddle-boom, and sometimes I'll go diddle-diddle-ba, you know, and just as the inspiration, as the moment occurs. And I suppose that, I was almost going to use the word discipline, that habit comes from playing Roxanne every night, and you look for some new way of doing it. And I suppose that idea of keeping it alive is not so relevant to a piece that I don't play 200 times a year.
There's, of course, a story which we should talk about behind the Tyrant's Crush. Describe that story to us.
It derives from the challenge, the daunting challenge of writing what they call absolute music, which is when the music has no subject. Concerto in C. Oh my gosh, where do you even start? I guess you start, okay, where's C on a piano? Dang, there's a C. Okay, so if you have a subject, you know, and this is where the film composing comes in, if you have a subject, then the colors emerge, the music flows, the river just provides the riff, the tune, the harmony, just it all just comes naturally.
There's
from
an emotional basis.
Yeah, an emotional basis, which gives, you know, where do you dig for, you know, and so that's what the story is about. It's not really important at all. It's really a composing aid. But since there was a story, I put it in the program notes. It's actually on the score. The first movement is the cheerful part where the young revolutionaries, they rise the nation up and they kick out the old regime. And there they arrive in the palace. And once they're in the palace, they kind of like that brocade and they kind of like the champagne. And it starts to, that's the cheerful part of the story. That's the first movement. Poltroons in Paradise. The second movement is Monster Just Needs Love, brackets, but ate the children anyway. And that's the part of the story where it's a second movement, which traditionally is a little slower, more introspective. That's where he's sitting at his big desk with big decisions to make. He's pretty much executed or imprisoned all the people who know how to run the country. And he's still trying to figure, you know, that's a more somber movement where he's having to deal with these weighty issues. And the third movement is where all hell breaks loose and he makes his escape. And that movement is called Over the Wall, brackets, or right. Up Against It.
How much of your upbringing, you grew up in Lebanon, where your father worked for the CIA. Was that in part an inspiration for this, being in that part of the world?
I think I might have inherited my father's taste for dictators. They're just so much more convenient than democratically elected leaders. In those Wild West days of the mid-40s, just after the war, when the beginning of the Cold War, when the world was being carved up between capitalism and democracy on one side and social communism on the other side, and the spheres of influence, it's all regarded as very Machiavellian now. And a lot of hoo-haws you hear about how the mistakes that were made in the past are the reason why we have the upset in the Middle East today. But in defense of my father, I would say that the regimes that they set up, the Assads in Syria, the royal families all over the Gulf, even Saddam Hussein. Okay, the Shah of Iran was not such a great idea. That didn't work out well. But really, my father and his cronies, the system that they set up survived them. It was still working. When my father died half a century later, it was still working. And it wasn't until we upset the apple cart by invading Iraq that it was inevitable anyway. I don't think it's all strictly the fault of that invasion. I think it was going to happen anyway because of internet, because of international interactions and codependence and so on. The Middle East, the medieval systems of the Middle East, their days were numbered. No matter who did what, it was going to explode just about now anyway. But it lasted half a century.
So tonight is the world premiere. Are you nervous at all? Are you confident that it's all going to come together and work the way you want it to? And What happens if it doesn't?
You know, it's a strange thing. There's nerves, I suppose, but really mostly excitement. It's a lot of fun to do. Rehearsal today went so well that I'm probably overconfident. It's exciting. It really is a different kind of thrill to play with this big orchestra. You know, I guess the first rehearsal is the most nerve-wracking, I guess, when you're there with, you know, 60 strangers and they're all looking at you, what's this guy going to come up with? But I'm so over that. I've been, you know, it's not my first time with the rodeo.
My guest has been Stuart Copeland. Tonight at 8, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra is presenting the world premiere of Mr. Copeland's The Tyrant's Crush. If you're planning to be at home for the 8 p.m. encore of Essential Pittsburgh, no worries. There's another performance Sunday afternoon at 2:30. And Stuart will be out front playing the drums. And if you were a fan of the Police back in the day, you know that he can play. Stuart Copeland, thanks so much for joining us. Best wishes on the premiere tonight.
Well, thank you so much.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA.